Larry Nall, and I'd like to welcome you to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, we are going to speak with Dr. Andrew Wakefield, board-certified physician who has been attacked mercilessly by the British Medical Journal, the Times of London, Brian Deer, and others in the British press, but also here in the United States. I've asked him a series of questions, and I'm giving him the full hour to address the issues. What happens when a courageous, independent scientist, following the rules of good science, discovers a possible connection between defective vaccines used, the MMR vaccines, measles, mumps, and rubella, and autistic spectrum disorder in the guts of some children? Let us go now to our interview with Dr. Andrew Wakefield.
I think that what I know now is that the problems with vaccines in general and the MMR vaccine specifically are far greater than I had previously anticipated. For example, Gary, I have four children. The first two children received the MMR vaccine. I, like so many parents, went along with the requirements and the recommendations for vaccination. I didn't, even as a physician and a scientist, I didn't question that, which I should have done. And when I started to question it around 1990-1991, the further I looked into it, the more concerned I became. And when I presented questions to those in authority, I found that the answers were completely unsatisfactory. Non-scientific, invested largely in a belief system, a hope, a wish, rather than hard scientific facts. And the more I've learned, the more concerned I have become, not only that the safety studies have not been done, but in some instances, as with, for example, the mumps vaccine, there was no need for this vaccination in the first place. Not my words, not my opinion, the opinion of the CDC and the regulators in the UK. So vaccines being introduced for commercial imperatives in the interests of the pharmaceutical companies rather than in the interests of the public. And that causes me huge concern. We cannot say that vaccines are safe. I'll give you, for example, Gary, the measles vaccine underwent relatively extensive testing. But when it was put into the combination measles, mumps and rubella, there were many, many assumptions made where you take three vaccines, three live viral vaccines, and you put them together in the same mix in a way in which the immune system, the human immune system throughout human evolution has never seen these infections before. And you limit the safety studies to 3, 4, 5 weeks when these are known to be viruses that are capable of hanging around in the body and causing delayed disease. One and one and one. Measles, mumps and rubella do not equal three. They equal something quite unknown. And so whereas it may have been justifiable to recommend measles vaccination on its own to protect against measles, which is a position that I have previously taken, to give a combination vaccine and then to load in, for example, other vaccines containing mercury preservatives and aluminum, which are going to alter the immune response even more profoundly, then no, we certainly do not, nor could anyone claim to know that those vaccines are safe. They are not, and there is a fundamental rule that something is unsafe until proven otherwise, and that is the situation in which we currently find ourselves. And then you come to the question of, are they efficacious? Do they actually protect against the diseases that they're meant to protect against? And I come back, for example, to the mumps vaccine. The mumps vaccine was introduced for commercial reasons, not for the benefit of children. It was the opinion of the CDC and others in the UK that this is a trivial disease in children. It was not needed. Now, here's the problem. If you use a vaccine that does not work properly, is not efficacious, then you are storing up major problems. Why? Because, for example, mumps, as you know, Gary, is a trivial disease in children, but is not trivial in particularly young post-adolescent males, post-pubertal males, where it can cause testicular inflammation and it can cause sterility. Testicular inflammation or coitus is also associated with later malignancy in the testicles. So, if the vaccine does not work, if it only protects you for, say, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, then by the time you are a teenager, you are no longer immune, and that is exactly what's happened. There have now been outbreaks of mumps, multiple outbreaks in children who've received multiple doses of the MMR vaccine. So what mumps vaccination has done, because the vaccine is not efficacious, has taken a trivial disease and turned it into a much more serious disease. And so there is a profound ecological impact on the human race for the introduction of these vaccines that has really been given scant attention, and now people are paying the price for that. So on both aspects of the question, Gary, I have major concerns. You correctly point out that public health seems to have taken the credit for reduction in morbidity and mortality from many infectious diseases. Now, the question is that justified? The most compelling data come from looking at mortality rates from infectious disease in developed countries over the last 150 years. And what we see is that there has been a striking decrease in case fatality rate, children dying from these infectious diseases long before there was any medical intervention such as, for example, antibiotics to treat primary or secondary bacterial pneumonias, or vaccination. There had been a 95% reduction in case fatality rate from measles long before any measles vaccine came along. So how can it be that vaccination can take the credit? Well, it may be that it has reduced the morbidity, the actual number of cases occurring, but has it had a substantial impact on the mortality? Well, the question there is, we don't know the answer. And we don't know the answer because we cannot say what would have happened if we had not vaccinated. Would that trend have continued downwards? And certainly for the mortality trend from measles, there was every indication that it was becoming vanishingly small, mortality from measles, in developed countries. So it's a very, very complex situation, but it's most certainly not appropriate for public health authorities to use that as an example of why we should be vaccinated, why we should be using mass immunization policies with untested vaccines. As you say, there are unprecedented levels of chronic immunological diseases in children, diseases that have never been seen either in this, of this nature or of this magnitude in the history of mankind. Anything from insulin-dependent diabetes through to autism, multiple sclerosis, inflammatory bowel disease, asthma, eczema, and so on and so forth. The common denominator for these diseases is a derangement in the immune function of children. And so the pertinent question is, what are the main determinants of immune function, healthy and unhealthy immune function in children? Historically, they were infectious diseases. Now, they are immunization. So is it biologically plausible that something like immunization practice, which is going deliberately to have a profound impact on a child's immunity, going to cause or potentially cause immunological diseases later in life? And I have to say that amongst the candidates for the cause of these various diseases, vaccines must rank number one. And they must be investigated appropriately. Now, the problem we come to is that there is a huge political and commercial imperative not to investigate that. Because clearly there are two issues there. There are issues of liability and there are issues of profits. So there is all the children who've been damaged, who would amount to an incalculable level of damage in monetary terms, and the loss of profits, which the pharmaceutical industry sees vaccination as being one of the mainstays of their future commercial programs, because other drugs, other mainstream drugs, are really a bust. They're going off off patent. They're being taken up by generics. So they're looking to vaccination, creating new markets in the field of vaccination to sustain their profit levels. And so up against this epidemic, this rising tide, this massive level of disease in children, you have these competing objectives. And it really, really is not in the best interests of the general public. Pediatrics has emerged from the field largely of dealing with infectious disease in children. So there's that historical legacy of seeing children who have suffered from or succumbed to infectious disease. So there's a sort of the background raison d'etre for pediatricians is to protect children from infectious disease. Now, vaccines appeared to give them the ability to do that, at least in part. The trouble is that then pediatricians became dependent upon immunization, well baby clinics, and multiple immunizations for their income. Once you become dependent on that for your income, you become less inquisitive. The busier you are, the less inquisitive you are, and the less time you have to check the facts. And some of the most tragic cases I've seen, Gary, have been pediatricians who have been raised in this arena, who have advocated vaccination, have given immunizations according to the prescribed schedule by the CDC and others, the Immunization Practices Committee here in the States, and then their own children have succumbed to these problems. And I met one such pediatrician, professor of pediatrics in Hong Kong, who had trained at Great Ormond Street, our preeminent pediatric centre in the UK, in London. And his own child, following immunisation, had regressed into autism. And his whole world was shattered. Everything that he had been raised to believe in, that he himself had taught to his students, the whole basis of his practice, was focused upon the consequence of what had happened to his own child. And he was unsure of where to go, what to do, what to think, or who to trust anymore. And I think we're going to see more and more and more of this as the numbers increase. I noticed just the other day there was several papers out from Dr. Bart Klassen from the NIH confirming confirmatory studies showing a link between the Haemophilus influenza B vaccine and insulin-dependent diabetes. This is a massive problem, a massive, massive problem that goes far beyond my immediate interests of inflammatory bowel disease and autism, but of huge concern, not only here in the West, but worldwide. We've been brought up to believe in medicine and science, and indeed in the general public now, that merely administering a vaccine to a person leads to their being immune to the diseases that that vaccine is meant to protect against. And there is really very little evidence to suggest or to confirm that that is the case. There are so many variables in this, and that includes the own the individual's genetic makeup. There is a lot of work now showing that there is a highly variable response to immunization depending upon your genetic makeup. So merely giving the vaccine to 10 people standing in a line doesn't mean that the immune response or the protective capacity of that vaccine is going to be the same in those individuals, each of those individuals. It is not. The other thing to say in respect of this is some very interesting work that has come out of Canada showing that those people who are immunized against the influenza vaccine, against influenza, using the influenza vaccine, when they get influenza, not protected, when they get influenza, it is worse. It is more serious in those who've received the vaccine than those who've not. Now, this goes against all the rules. How does that happen? How is it the case that giving the vaccine makes the disease worse when people get it? Most alarming. And so what it tells us, Gary, is that we know actually very little. The more we learn, the more we realize we don't know. So many assumptions have been made in the field of immunization, and those assumptions have been passed on to the general public to get them to believe, to coerce them, to persuade them, to intimidate them, to terrify them, to make them get vaccinated. And yet the facts, the informed consent that should be given to parents or patients about the benefits or risks of immunization are really very scant and based upon very little true fact at all. You see a unique relationship in the field of immunisation whereby government committees, public health doctors, scientists are advising on immunisation practices, not unreasonably, but providing rules and regulations that society needs to follow, and the pharmaceutical industry following on in their wake. Now, I've lived through several examples of the political nature of the problem that we face. And one of them, a sort of classic illustration, is the introduction of the Urabi AM9 strain mumps vaccine in the UK. Here is a political situation in which the UK wants to introduce MMR vaccine, wants to do so based upon the apparent success of this vaccine in the US. But it wants to use a UK-based vaccine made by SmithKline Beecham, which contains a mumps vaccine called Urabi AM9. The Urabi AM9 is a dangerous vaccine. It's overreactive. It produces meningitis. So in the UK, the government committee asked an expert to come and advise them from Canada, where they'd been having problems with that vaccine and indeed where it was withdrawn. The advisor came over and he told them, the UK, not to use SmithKline Beecham's vaccine containing the Urabi AM9. But SmithKline Beecham was the home team. Merck was charging a lot of money for their vaccine, so the UK wanted the home team's vaccine, which was cheaper, knowing that it was problematic, that it was causing meningitis. So what do they do? And here we see an example of this cozy relationship between the industry and the politicians. Is that what appears to have happened is that the politicians, the government, the British government, gave them an exemption from liability. They took over their liability, quite unheard of in the UK before. That I can produce this vaccine and I can profit from it, but I have absolutely no liability for the side effects of this vaccine, the known side effects, the ones that the government has already been warned against. And what happens is the vaccine gets introduced, SmithKline Beecham get 85% of the home market. 4 years later, the vaccine has to be withdrawn almost overnight because it's producing unprecedented levels of meningitis. And since that time, there has been a strenuous effort to cover it up from the political perspective. So unlike any other situation that I'm aware of, here you have this liaison dangereuse between the pharmaceutical industry on the one hand and the government and its advisors on the other hand, and the public paying the price right in the middle. There are scientists for hire taken on board by the pharmaceutical companies who are sitting on government advisory committees which are responsible for licensing or recommending licenses for particular vaccines. And this is unacceptable. But it has been something that's just been swept under the carpet. You announce your conflict and you get on with its business as usual. Well, a lot of those conflicts aren't even announced, and certainly they're not they're not quantified in any way. I've experienced this at many levels, not only in the vaccine licensing process, but in the courts where the vaccine advisors, the experts coming forward to testify on behalf of the vaccine manufacturers, the defendants, are being funded heavily by the pharmaceutical industry. And then in my own experience at the General Medical Council, physicians funded by the pharmaceutical industry going after other doctors who are acting on behalf of these children. What was particularly interesting is the case of Professor Sir Michael Rutter. Professor Sir Michael Rutter was a witness against me at the General Medical Council and against my colleagues. And when asked if he would have declared the fact that there was MMR litigation, which was known to the Lancet at the time, and that I was involved in it, would he have declared it in the Lancet paper, which had absolutely nothing to do with that litigation, then he said yes, he would. In fact, when you go and look at it, he published four papers while acting as an expert for the defendants, the pharmaceutical industry, in the US and the UK, where he failed to disclose in those papers any conflict of interest at all. That's alarming because not only that, he sat on the board of some of those journals which had a very strict editorial policy demanding disclosure of conflict of interest. And yet when he went up to give evidence against me, he said he would have disclosed. Well, it's a case of do what I say, not what I do. And that hypocrisy needs to be identified and stamped out. I don't know how many viewers know the story, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, a poem by Samuel Taylor Coleridge. But my unusual medical story is not unlike that of the ancient mariner who killed an albatross, the good luck omen of sailors, and he and his colleagues paid a terrible price, and his job thereafter, his role was to wander the earth, cornering people and telling them his story in the hope that they too wouldn't make the same mistake. I am a mainstream physician. I am an academic gastroenterologist. I trained in surgery, having qualified in medicine at St. Mary's Hospital in London. I went on in my academic career to publish 130, 140 peer-reviewed papers, chapters, and invited articles. And my principal interest was Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, inflammatory bowel diseases that, certainly in the case of Crohn's, were a growing problem, an epidemic problem. And with a group of doctors in London at the Royal Free Hospital, part of the University of London, I was involved in looking at the origins and nature of inflammatory bowel disease. I started to develop an interest in possible viral infectious causes for inflammatory bowel disease in the late 80s, early 90s, and became particularly interested in measles. As a consequence of that interest, we published various papers, and in 1995, in the middle of May of 1995, I had a call from a parent, a very articulate mother, who told me the story of her own child. He had developed normally, he acquired speech and language, interaction with his siblings, and then after the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, he had regressed into autism. Not only that, he had developed severe gastrointestinal problems. These had not been adequately investigated. Because of his autism, they had been largely put to one side. Your child is autistic, they're bound to have such bowel problems. Now, he was lucky. He had actually doctors with some insight. Even though they didn't understand the nature of the problem, they were prepared to look further. And so a referral was made to my colleague, Professor John Walker Smith. John was one of the world's leading pediatric gastroenterologists, indeed one of the founding fathers of pediatric gastroenterology. And to move forward in time, this child was admitted to the Royal Free and investigated for clinical reasons for his bowel symptoms and his autism. And we discovered a novel inflammatory bowel disease. It was subtle, it was mild, but it was nonetheless a definite disease. And we went through an extremely rigorous process of diagnosis with not one but multiple physicians looking down the microscope to determine whether or not there was disease in these children. When we treated the disease in these children, then their condition improved. Not only did their bowel disease improve, but their autism symptoms improved as well. Over the latter half of the 1995-96, we started to get more and more calls with parents telling exactly the same story. And these children were duly investigated for their clinical problems, and the bowel disease was confirmed in the great majority. Also, the clinical response to treatment of the bowel disease was really quite striking. It was a sort of Lorenzo's oil situation where something quite unexpected was happening. Yes, we thought the bowel symptoms might improve, but we did not expect that the autism symptoms would improve, certainly to the extent that they did. It appeared to go above and beyond just the children feeling better. Their speech would come back. They would become more balanced, they would sleep better. They'd become more articulate. Their tantruming would go away. So here we have a situation where the parents had said one thing: my child has bowel problems, I'm sure they have some underlying disease that is associated with their autism, and they were right. They were absolutely right. And when we treated that, their children got better. So here we have a very, very powerful example of a parental insight leading to a what's turned out to be a major breakthrough in autism. Indeed, one of the most important breakthroughs in autism during the course of the history of this disease. And now a lot of papers are being published on the back of this, confirming not only the disease in these children, but other bowel-related abnormalities that suggest this may be a primary intestinal problem. The problem was, however, that the parents had associated their child's decline with a vaccine. If they hadn't, if it had been something else, if it had been that they caught a fever and regressed, they got an infectious disease, then it would have been a different story. But because it was a vaccine, that could not possibly be. And the dean of the medical school, when the first paper came out in 1998, February 98, in The Lancet, an eminent, well-respected medical journal, the dean called a press conference. And before that press conference, many over the preceding months and years, I had been investigating the safety of MMR vaccine. I'd taken a profound interest because the parents were right about the bowel disease, were they right about the vaccine? It was plausible and therefore it needed to be investigated. Was it a novel complication arising out of the use of a triple vaccine that, in my opinion, had been inadequately tested? And so what I did was to write a 250-page report on the safety of that vaccine, the pre-licensing safety studies before it was put into the marketplace to determine whether it was safe or not. And I was appalled by what I found. I mean, the research that had gone into it was seriously below par and called into question many of the assumptions and conclusions that had been drawn about this vaccine. So I said to my colleagues, look, the paper's coming out, it's going to attract a lot of interest, there's going to be a press briefing called by the dean. If I am asked by a parent or by a member of the media, then I am not in a position to support the use of the MMR vaccine any longer. I will happily support the use of single vaccines. I will advocate for the use of single vaccines, but I have major concerns about the combined vaccine. At that point, the dean of the medical school could have done one of three things. He could have cancelled the press conference. He could have banned me from the press conference. Or, number three, if at the press conference that question had been asked, he could direct it to someone else because he was chairman of that press conference. On the day when the question was asked, as it was always going to be asked, he directed the question straight to me. And I gave the answer that I had told my colleagues in writing I would give if asked. And that is that I would recommend separation of the vaccines. Well, uproar ensued from there, and there was a huge reaction from the politicians, from the Lancet itself, from everybody about the paper, making this claim based upon a study of 12 children. No, it wasn't. It was not based on a study of 12 children. It was based upon a 250-page report generated out of reading the science behind the licensing of the MMR vaccine. And it was a position that I had stated clearly I would adopt from that point forward. Now, some years later, I lost my job at the Royal Three. I encountered the new Professor of Medicine, Professor Mark Pepys, who, in fact, when recruited to the Royal Three, refused to come unless I had been sacked from the staff. People did not want that to happen, and so they called his bluff and he came anyway to the Royal Free. When he came there, he got me into his office and he told me that I did not form part of the future of his plans for the Department of Medicine. He said that my science was bad. I said to him, Professor Pepys, it's interesting you should say that. How many of my papers have you actually read? And he said, I don't need to. So I said, who is the bad scientist? Our relationship really didn't get off to a terribly good start, as you can imagine. But here is someone making a decision about my career and the work that I was doing and the direction that work was going based upon never having read a single word of what we'd written. Who's the bad scientist? Anyway, I was eventually forced out of the Royal Free, I took the decision to leave based upon the fact that the work was becoming constrained. I could no longer do the work. I could no longer pursue this objective because the environment wouldn't allow me to do that. Grants were being blocked. All manner of things were going on in the background that I've only learned about more recently. So I decided to come to America because even though the argument is equally polarized in this country, there is at least the ability in this country to conduct research in a relatively free manner. Relatively free, certainly compared with countries like the UK, where it appears to me at least that the pharmaceutical industries own much of the medical school. And they get to say largely what happens in terms of research output. They provide a lot of the grants. A lot of the people working there are working as experts on behalf of those companies. So I moved to the United States to continue the work. It was in 2004 that I first became aware that a journalist, a reporter, working with the Sunday Times, a Murdoch newspaper, need I say any more, who was investigating our work and making outrageous claims against me and against my colleagues. That, for example, there was not an ethical approval to conduct the research on these children. That the work that was being done on these children was being done for research purposes and not for clinical purposes. Let me characterize that. Here you have one of the world's leading pediatric gastroenterologists with his team of expert, well-trained gastroenterologists making clinical decisions about children, and Brian Deer stepping in and saying he does not, in his opinion, believe that these children required clinical investigation. You can see how absurd this situation becomes. That we didn't have ethical approval, that there was a conflict of interest because the children in the Lancet paper were being recruited by a lawyer for the purpose of a legal case. No, they weren't. Not a single child in that Lancet study was a litigant or even contemplating litigation, as far as I was aware, when they were recruited. Sorry, let me amend that, Gary. When they were referred to the Royal Free Hospital for clinical investigation. And a litany of similar allegations were then placed first before the editor of The Lancet, who dismissed the great majority of them, but who said that in his opinion there was a possible perceived conflict of interest, that the litigation had not been disclosed in the Lancet paper. Well, the rules of disclosure at the time did not involve perception of a conflict of interest. They were what I considered, as an author, in my opinion, to be a conflict. And none of my co-authors, not the dean of the medical school, not my line manager, none of us considered that at the time to be a conflict, because none of those children were involved in litigation. And so what happened next is Brian Deer went to the General Medical Council with his complaint, which contained, again, a whole slew of contrived charges against us based on the flimsiest of evidence. But what he appears to have done is got this notion fixed in his head that this is what had happened and that he was going to demonstrate his idea, his belief, what come what may. I'll give you an example. He had gone to the home of the first child, whose mother contacted me way back in May 1995, and he had gained admission to her home to interview her under a false name. He had lied to that mother, deliberately intending to mislead her in order that she could not identify who he was, check on his past, and refuse on the basis of informed consent to give an interview or not. So, again, just as an example of Brian Deer's behaviour, his approach to this, is that he went to the home of the child who was the son of the mother who first came to me in May 1995. And he entered her home for the purpose of interviewing her for the Sunday Times newspaper under a false name. He gave her a false name. He lied to her deliberately in order to prevent her checking on his background, which was most certainly anti-plaintiff, anti-parent, in such cases. And she had given an interview on the basis of his false name. She had been deceived. That is a measure of Brian Deer. That is a measure of the way in which he practices what he does. So when it came to the General Medical Council hearing after many, many years of investigation, we felt we had a compelling case. There were three defendants, three legal teams who believed that we had a very, very strong case, which really blew much of what Brian Deer had said and what the GMC had alleged completely out of the water. When it came to it, the first person to be appointed to the panel to chair the panel that was sitting in judgment on us, three doctors and two lay people, the first person was removed from the panel and replaced by Professor Angus McDevitt. It then turned out that Professor McDevitt sat on the committee that was responsible for the introduction of the dangerous MMR vaccine in the UK in the first place. A conflict of interest? Most certainly. When this conflict was pointed out to the General Medical Council and it was put to Professor McDevitt, he'd forgotten that he was on that committee. Nonetheless, in the face of questions from the press, they were forced to back down and take him off. The next person to come on board was Dr. Surinder Kumar, a general practitioner from the north of England. After passing judgment on my colleagues and me, In 2007, within a few months, Dr. Kumar addressed a meeting of doctors in the UK demanding compulsory, mandatory vaccination of British school children with MMR. He said children should not be allowed to go to school. They are a threat to others if they have not received this vaccine. That is a conflict of interest. A position that was so clearly polarised, so clearly biased, that he was not fit to sit in judgment on the hearing. Nonetheless, two of my colleagues, my colleague Professor Walker-Smith and I, were erased from the medical register, despite having what we believed to be a very, very strong case. I tried to appeal, I lodged an appeal, but I did not have the financial resources, which may have amounted up to £500,000, $750,000, to conduct such an appeal. Professor Walker-Smith, on the other hand, had his appeal funded, and he won. He won absolutely and comprehensively. In fact, the judge, Justice Mitting, effectively ruled that the GMC panel were incompetent, that they mishandled the evidence, that they were guilty of bias, that their decisions were perverse, and that the GMC, the General Medical Council, needed to overhaul its practice of sitting in judgment on doctors on the basis of the incompetent way in which this case was handled. Highly embarrassing for the General Medical Council, and on the basis of that, I have now sought to start my appeal up again. So that is awaited. In the US, I was able to continue my work. We were conducting research. Life brings you to a crossroads. In many instances, here was a crossroads. I could walk away and I could say, well, you know, this isn't my problem. I don't have an autistic child. But my duty as a doctor, confronted with parents who have badly damaged children, who we've got some insight into why and how we might put this right. It's impossible. It's unethical. It's certainly unprofessional and irresponsible to turn your back on those people and say, look, I know you're right, but it's your problem, it's not mine. And sadly, so many doctors have done exactly that. So I decided to go forward and to continue this work to its natural conclusion, whatever the price, whatever the consequences might be, because not to do so would be unthinkable and would be a violation of the parents' trust and it would render my medical training completely meaningless, and that is putting the patient first and foremost, without compromise, without contradiction, but to put the patient first. I'm not here to serve the pharmaceutical industry or public health initiatives. That's someone else's issue. My job as a physician is to put the patient first. So we pursued the work, I pursued the research in this country, and we were producing some fascinating results, particularly in respect of studies in primates, looking at the vaccine schedule in primates. And I suspect that largely because of that, despite the fact that they had attacked me in the UK, that I'd lost my medical license, that I had been the subject of vilification worldwide, the fact that there were still many, many, many parents who were invested in this, who believed in it, because they saw what had happened to their own child, then the work was allowed to continue, and somehow they had to stop that. And the opinion polls that were going on around this country and around the world were showing that parents did not trust vaccines. That whatever the propaganda that was being put out there, whatever the message that was being construed at vast expense by public health and pharmaceutical industry giants, then people weren't believing it. They weren't buying into it. They were losing the hearts and minds of people because they were seeing this problem in their communities, in their schools, in their families. They knew there was a problem. Instinctively, they knew there was a problem. And I was merely an instrument of that and someone who had put themselves out there to try and answer the question. So in the face of that continuing attrition of public confidence in the vaccine policymakers, not in vaccines, but in vaccine policymakers, then they had to attack me further. And the next series of attacks came in the form of another set of articles by Brian Deer, this time in the British Medical Journal, saying that the work was not only unethical and wrong, it was fraud. That I and I alone had fraudulently manipulated the data in that Lancet paper to create the appearance of a novel disease in these children, the link between the bowel disease and the autism, in order to bring about the downfall of the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. This is an extraordinary story that all of the other authors, the other 12 authors on the paper, who between them have published thousands of prestigious journals, articles in journals, who are world leaders in their field, suddenly went to sleep at the switch. That I was able to conduct this elaborate fraud behind their backs without them knowing, when in fact it was they who had made the diagnoses. Please, really. And yet this fantastical story was allowed to gain momentum in the press and elsewhere, even amongst medical colleagues who seemed to have put reason on hold, who seemed to have suspended logic because they were hearing what they wanted to hear. We are not responsible. Medicine didn't do this. It wasn't a vaccine. Vaccines are fine. There was this cognitive dissonance. We're hearing what we want, so we will shut out reason and believe this journalist against the word of all of these doctors. It really is bizarre. And so as a consequence of that, and our clear ability to prove our case that there was absolutely no fraud, there was, in fact, a very important discovery of a novel disease process in these children that can be treated, that can open up new avenues for treatment of these children. Then I filed a case in defamation here in Texas against Brian Deer, the editor of the BMJ, and the British Medical Journal itself. Let's go through point by point what Brian Deer and the BMJ said and examine it in the context of what actually happened. I was accused of altering patient records and patient data in order to create the impression of a novel disease in these children. This relates specifically, as an example, to the pathology in the disease of in the intestine of these children. What was seen by the pathologists down the microscope? Deer says that nothing was seen, that it was normal. Whereas we said in the Lancet paper that there was inflammation. There was a colitis, a non-specific colitis. What does that mean? It means that it's neither Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, two classic forms of inflammatory bowel disease. Doesn't mean that it's not important or treatable, it just means that it's not classical inflammatory bowel disease. The basis of Deer's argument is that the routine reports that come out of the routine pathology laboratory in many cases said there were no abnormalities or minor abnormalities of uncertain significance. Now, let me take you through the process, the meticulous process by which the diagnoses were made. Every biopsy taken from a patient undergoing surgery or colonoscopy, for example, is sent to the pathology laboratory where it is reviewed by the routine pathologist. Now, that pathologist is just on duty that day. He may not have any knowledge of bowel disease in children, but he is a generalist, or he has a specialization in breast cancer or brain tumors. He then issues a report which goes into the child's notes. Now, Professor Walker Smith, as part of his routine clinical practice, something he has been doing for years and years and years, because he has an unparalleled experience in bowel disease in children, would meet with the pathologist and his team once a week. And they would have what they call a clinico-pathological review. They would go through every single slide on every child that they had biopsied from the week before. What he noted and what his team noted is that the pathologists, the routine pathologists, were missing significant disease in these children. So not trusting in his own expert judgment, he went to the lead, the top intestinal pathologist in the hospital, Dr. Dillon, and he asked him to review these children's biopsies blinded. What does that mean? It means that Dr. Dillon does not know anything about the clinical history in these children or their symptoms. He is merely asked to look at the biopsies down the microscope and assess what he finds there. What he did was to record those findings in a standard scoring sheet, which gives him, you know, a grade of 1, 2, 3 for mild, moderate or severe inflammation. When he did that, he found that there was colitis in the great majority, in all but one of the 12 children. Not satisfied with that, there was then a further review by another pathologist, Dr. Susan Davis, which was conducted with all of the pathologists present, where they concur with those diagnoses. I did not take part in this process in terms of making the diagnosis. I could not have fabricated those data. Those results were arrived at by expert pathologists conferring one with another about what was happening in these children. What I did was to take their findings and write them up in the Lancet paper, a paper which they had drafts of before publication so that they could comment on the findings. They approved the findings, they approved the description, and the paper was published. So there you have a classic example of how a very diligent process, a process that went above and beyond the call of duty, certainly above and beyond what happens in most institutions, to determine that there was a genuine disease process in these children, was corrupted by Brian Deer. Why corrupted? Because he knew that that process had taken place. He had an abundance of evidence that that due diligence had taken place. And yet what he did is to compare the routine pathologist's result with what was seen in the Lancet and say they're different and therefore there is fraud. And he missed out everything that occurred in between. That is extraordinary, it's irresponsible, and it is in itself fraudulent. And that's just one example. He then went through the clinical histories of the children, saying that we were wrong. That in fact, the clinical records to which he had access, or the transcripts of the General Medical Council hearing, where many of the children's histories were read out loud, did not concur with what was written in the Lancet paper. And what we have been able to show unequivocally is that what was written in the Lancet paper was an accurate representation of the information available to us at the time, and indeed remains an accurate representation. There was no fraud. There was no changing of data. What was written in the Lancet was accurate and remains true to this day. So Brian Deer then went on to say that, well, the study was funded by The legal aid board, no, it was not. And he knew that. I had told him that. Their documents had shown him that. The funding for the legal aid board study was not even available to be spent until after that Lancet study had been written, the last patient seen, and the paper submitted to the Lancet for publication. No money could possibly have been spent from the legal aid board on that study. And yet that remains Brian Deer's contention to this day, based upon what evidence, I do not know. And yet this has found its way into the public domain, into the media, into the public consciousness as matters of fact. And they are in themselves absolutely wrong and in many cases fraudulent. One thing that's come out of this, and one thing that the BMJ have tried to hammer home and other journalists have picked up on, is the fact that parents are not getting vaccinated now because they are scared, and that as a consequence of that, infectious diseases are coming back, measles is coming back, and children will die, or children will represent a threat to other children if these diseases come back. Let me clarify my position on this. Back at that press briefing in 1998, I strongly recommended the continued use of single vaccines. I'd reviewed the history of those vaccines, and at least for measles virus, they were very, very much better in terms of the safety studies than they were for the MMR. So I did not at all recommend the abandoning of vaccination. Children, at the time I said, should continue to be vaccinated against these diseases. At that time, in the UK, the single vaccines were available on the National Health Service. They were available free to children. The choice was there. I was advocating for choice. What happened was that the government unilaterally withdrew the importation license for the single measles vaccine 6 months later. What an extraordinary situation. Here you are trying to protect children from infectious diseases. Parents have genuine concerns about the safety of MMR, and yet you're removing their choice of how they should protect their children. Well, if your principal interest is to protect children from infectious disease, why would you do that? And I put this to the government, a government official or one of the regulators, and I said, why would they do this? And she said, well, if we allowed people to have the choice of single vaccines, it would destroy our MMR program. In other words, her concern was not about protection of the children, but protection of the program. And that underscores the hypocrisy that pervades this whole argument. But since that time, and since these diseases have come back, at least in part, because the single vaccine, the option of the single vaccine has been withdrawn, then I have been to blame. And every time there's an outbreak of measles, however big, however small in the UK, I am to blame. And this is part of that lame public relations exercise, which is an extravagant effort on the part of the government and the public health authorities in the UK to displace the blame to someone else for something for which they are wholly responsible. They took away the option. If diseases come back, it is their fault. It is their fault. And if children die, it is their responsibility. So that is something that I continue to be blamed for in the UK and indeed the US. And is wholly unjustified. What I am in favour of is safe vaccination policy. You can make a very good case for protecting children against infectious, dangerous infectious diseases with a safe and efficacious vaccine. So if a vaccine is not safe, is not efficacious, and the disease is not dangerous, then there is no need for that vaccine. That is my position. Now, sorry, Gary, what was the last thing? That was, the media. An example of how the media have handled this is really what's been driven by the media. It's been driven by Brian Deer. It's been driven by Rupert Murdoch's Sunday Times. And that really speaks volumes. We've learned so much about Rupert Murdoch and his son, James Murdoch, since the scandal that has taken place with phone hacking in the UK. We can see the standard to which these people operate, how trustworthy they actually are. People who are prepared to misrepresent the facts even before the British government. People who have been labelled by British members of Parliament as unfit to be in charge of corporations. So that is the standard at which this is being conducted, is being operated. Now, there are close links between the media and the pharmaceutical industry. James Murdoch was on the board of GlaxoSmithKline, one of the principal protagonists in this argument. And what we've seen since then is other media outlets getting involved. And what we see in the United States of America is a situation in which the media, particularly the television advertising media, is dependent upon the pharmaceutical industry for their income. And therefore, they are limited in what they're able to say at risk of losing that income. So they're no longer news agencies. They're no longer news outlets. They're not able to give you an unbiased picture of what is actually going on because they are dependent financially upon the pharmaceutical industry. And that is a travesty, but it is a fact of life. I believe that someone who has recently left a major news corporation in the United States of America has talked about the pressures that the newscasters come under to give the government lying or a line that is contrary to the facts. And that is something I'm afraid that the public have come to expect now. And this is in part the reason why the public are so sceptical about government proclamations and media articles about how safe these vaccines are when they can see with their own eyes that they're a problem. I have been treated in a particular way by Anderson Cooper and others, by Matt Lauer, often not even being allowed to articulate an answer to a question, being interrupted continuously, not being allowed to get a point across, not good journalism, not objective journalism, not balanced journalism, but part of a preconceived notion of how this needs to be handled in order to achieve a predetermined result. And that's a great shame again. Does it alter anything? Does it make a difference in the end? No, the truth will come out.
Thank you very much, Dr. Wakefield. I appreciate your input. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.